Would you pray with me? Loving God, we are yours. We come as we are with our cares and our concerns. We long to touch you and find healing in your embrace. Strengthen our faith and heal our brokenness that we may worship you with joy. Amen. Jesus had crossed back over to the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, took to the Jewish side. Now, it isn't really a sea at all, but rather a large freshwater lake, some 13 miles long and 8 miles across. And it's surrounded by high mountains, and it's apparently roughly in the shape of a heart. Which is rather wonderful if you stop and think about it. A heart-shaped lake at the heart of where it all happened. And after leaving Nazareth, Jesus seems to have spent most of what was left of his short life in the city of Capernaum, which is on the northern shore of the lake, and it's the center of its fishing industry. A number of his best friends lived there, including Zebedee's two sons, James and John, together with Peter and Andrew, who were all of them partners in some sort of fishing business that employed other people whose names we don't know, and that seems to have owned at least two boats. Interestingly, Mark puts so many more details into his story. Mark's usually the just the facts, ma'am, type guy. He puts many more details in this story than Matthew does. And it almost seems like he must have actually either been there at the time or at least had talked with somebody who was. It sort of has the ring of an eyewitness account. And it makes it a little easier for us to see all these centuries later with our eyes. And you know, I think we should always try to do that with stories about Jesus. Hearing them preached on a Sunday in church year after year, or reading them in the dreary double columns of our Bibles, we tend to think of them as dreary themselves. Little stained glass window stories, suitable for theologizing and moralizing, but without much life in them or much relevance to the reality of our own lives and to us. But that's not the kind of story that Mark is telling us here, if you think about it, or if you don't think about it, but just listen to it. Let me take you wherever it's going. It's a quiet, low-key story. And in some ways, it's unclear and ambiguous that it's hard to know just exactly what Mark is telling or what he expects us to make out of it, or even maybe what he made out of it himself. It's a story not about stained glass people at all, but people who lived and breathed and sweated and made love and used bad language when they tripped over furniture in the dark. And sometimes had more troubles than they knew what to do with. And sometimes laughed themselves silly over nothing in particular. They were people, in many ways, very much like the rest of us. So Jesus had just crossed over in a boat from the other side of the lake, Mark writes, and he found himself surrounded by some of those people right here at the water's edge, where there were nets hanging up to dry and fish being gutted and scaled and stray cats looking around for something they could get their paws on. He didn't say there was any particular reason for the crowd, so it's probably that they had just heard about Jesus. Probably even knew him, some of them. And were there to stare at him because there were a lot of wild stories going about who some people said who he was and what he was doing around the countryside. And they were there to see what wild things he might do next. In fact, there were so many people around him, it's hard to pick out who he was. But it's worth giving it a try. Is he the one with his hand in the air, signaling to somebody he couldn't get to on the far edge of the crowd? Is he the thin, sad-faced one who looks a little like Osama bin Laden, of all people? Is he the one leaning over and reaching out to take something a child is trying to hand to him? What would it feel like to be near enough to touch him, if you dared? If his eyes happened to meet yours for a moment, what would you say if you could find the right words for saying it? And how would he answer you if he could even hear you over the midst of all of the babbling and jostling of the crowd? What if, just for a moment, he tried to shoulder his way past you out of the crowd, and he brushed against you so that for a second or two you actually felt the solid flesh and bone, smelled the smell of him? I think that that's part of all the stories about Jesus in the Gospels, that that's what they're trying to tell us if we keep our eyes open. They're trying to tell us what there was about him that at least made some of the people there by the lake on that day decide to give up everything that they had or ever hoped to have, and in some cases even their lives, maybe just for the sake of being near him. Now, Matthew's account doesn't give us the name Jairus, but Mark's does. There was a man named Jairus, he says, who somehow made his way to Jesus and threw himself at his feet, as Mark describes it, falling on his knees, perhaps, or touching his forehead to the ground in front of him. He was a synagogue official of some kind, Mark says, whatever that exactly means, but an important man anyhow, which is possibly why the crowd gave way enough to let him through. But he doesn't behave like an important man, though. He behaves like a desperate man, a man close to hysteria with fear, grief, and horror. God knows what. And the reason is that his daughter is at the point of death. Jairus says not only, he doesn't say only, my daughter. He says, my little daughter. Now, she's 12 years old, going on 13, we're told, so she wasn't at all really that little. But to Jairus, she would presumably always be his little daughter. The way, even when they're grown up and moved away long since, we keep on speaking of our sons and daughters as children, because that's what they were when we first knew them and first loved them. His child is dying, is what Jairus is there to get through somehow to this man. Some say is like no other man. She's dying, he says. He says it repeatedly. Mark tells us, dying, dying. And then he says, come and lay your hands on her. Because she's seen it done that way before and possibly even tried it that way himself, except that it did absolutely no good. But this is the only way, the only card he has left to play. And he plays it. Lay your hands on her so that she might be well and live, he says. Live, he says. Live, live, not die. Before she's hardly had more than a glimpse of what living is. Now, it's a wonder that Jesus even hears him. What with all the other things people are clamoring to him for. But somehow he does. And so does a lot of the crowd that follows along as Jairus leads the way to where his home stands. Now they follow, the crowd that is, presumably because for the moment Jesus is the hottest ticket in town. And because they don't have anything better to do, and because they're eager to see if the man is all that he's cracked up to be. And on the way, our story gets interrupted. It's interrupted by the story of a bleeding woman. She's been suffering for 12 years from hemorrhaging. And Mark doesn't tell us her name, her age, or really anything else about her. He introduces her with a string of misfortune. She's been bleeding for 12 years. She's endured great physical, mental, and emotional stress under the care of many physicians. Has spent all that she had with no benefit. And despite all of that, she was only getting worse. Whoever she is, or whatever she had done prior to this sickness, her condition is now what defines her. It's taken over her identity and, yes, even her life. It marks her as ceremonially unclean and isolates her from the world. It's made her a picture of despair. With nobody to represent her, but wanting desperately to be healed, the woman takes the matter into her own hands. Her depression or desperation and courage to seek Jesus speak louder about her, about who she is, than does her illness. And with her frail body, she wedges her way through the crowd and stealthily comes up on Jesus. Whatever it was that she had heard about Jesus had convinced her that even touching the edge of his robe would restore her health and she would be completely healed. And true to her faith, she is miraculously healed. And her healing is so instantaneous and evident that she actually feels her symptoms vanish. Jesus is so powerful that even touching his robe is enough to cure her completely. And she's filled with awe and with fear at the power of Jesus. And she's afraid because Jesus notices that power has been released from him. And he begins to investigate as to who it was that touched him. His disciples blow him off. blaming the crowd, shoving and pushing around him. But he doesn't stop asking. He's determined to find out who it was that approached him in faith, even discreetly. And the woman, she can't hide anymore. She must face the consequences of having contaminated every person and thing that she's come into contact with. But more importantly, she must come face to face with Jesus, the powerful divine image before her. Trembling in fear, she falls down before Jesus and tells him the truth. The woman who had lived so many years in the shadows, plagued by her own tragic story, now she has to come out into the light and tell a new story. And to her surprise, Jesus doesn't reprimand her or shame her for her actions. He restores her dignity by calling her daughter. Though her illness had forced her to hide away from the rest of the world, Jesus saw her to her core. He saw her desperate faith. And he pronounces divine peace over her and publicly confirms her complete healing before eyewitnesses. And as Jesus is speaking to her, messengers arrive from the house of Jairus. They brought devastating news. Your daughter is dead, they tell him. They had seen her die with their own eyes. There was nothing anybody could do anymore. They had come too late. Why trouble the teacher any further? They ask her father, and it's Jesus who finally breaks the silence by speaking. But it's only to Jairus that he speaks to. Do not fear, he says. Do not be afraid. And then, only believe. He tells him to just have faith. The question is, what's a man to believe when his whole life has blown up in his face? Believe that somehow life makes sense even in the face of a 12-year-old's death? Believe that there is some unmanageable way out of all of this, no matter what? Believe in God? Believe in Jesus? Jairus doesn't talk or doesn't ask what he is to believe or how he is to believe, and Jesus doesn't tell him as they stand there on the road. Only believe is all he says. Meaning maybe only believe there's nothing you have to be afraid of. And then he tells everybody to go home except for his three friends, who Mark tells us are Peter, James, and John. And everybody goes home. And when the five of them finally get to Jairus' house, they find it full of people weeping and wailing, the way Mark describes it. Because this is not the 21st century, but the first century, and people apparently haven't started yet saying things like, it's really a blessing, or she's in a better world now. Because for the most part, they didn't believe in any better world, but just some sort of limbo world under the earth where the ghosts of the dead drift like dead leaves. Instead, they wept and they wailed, because they didn't have it in them to pretend the death of a child was anything but tragic. And Jesus didn't say anything to make them change their minds. didn't tell them that it was God's will or anything like that. What he did instead was to say something that it's hard to know how to understand. "The child is dead," he said. "Is not dead, but sleeping." Now, what was he speaking literally? Did he mean that she had lapsed into some kind of coma? Or was he only trying to comfort her father with the thought that death is only a kind of eternal sleep? Who knows what he meant? But the people in the house seemed to think that he was either a fool or a madman. They had been there when it had happened. They knew death when they saw it. And because the line between weeping and laughing is sometimes a very thin one, they stopped their weeping and wailing, and of all things, they laughed at Jesus. Mark said, laughed because they didn't know what else to do. Until Jesus finally put them all outside, so that there were only the three fishermen friends, along with Jesus and Jairus and the child's mother. And together they went to the room where the child lay. I think it's the deafening stillness of it that you can best imagine. The mother with her face in her hands, Jairus on his knees at the bedside, the child like the waxwork of a child, hair brushed, face washed, hands folded, one on top of the other on her chest. And then the moment of magic, if magic is what it was. It's the child herself that Jesus speaks to. He reaches down, picks up one of her hands in his hand, and Mark reports the words he used, not in Greek, which is what the rest of his gospel is written in, but in Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus actually spoke. So somebody was there at the time and must have heard them and remembered them. The actual words that he used as he reached out and lifted up the child's hand in his. "Talitha kum," Jesus says. "Talitha kum," and you hardly need the translation to understand it. "Little girl, Talitha, get up," is what he said. And now, according to Mark, she immediately got up and started to walk. And they were overcome with amazement. It was not just the child's life that had been given back, but the lives of the mother and the father who stood there with no words that they knew how to say. The worst thing that had ever happened to them has suddenly become the best thing that ever happened to them. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine that they hardly dare so much as to breathe for fear of breaking the spell. You can imagine her walking around the room, touching familiar things, a chair, a comb, a flower somebody had left, a chipped plate, trying to get the world back, trying to get herself back. And for whatever the reason, Jesus asked them never to tell a soul what had happened. Maybe because he wasn't yet ready for the secret of who he was to be known yet. Maybe because he wasn't sure he knew the secret of who he was himself yet. Who can say? Then he told them to get the child something to eat. something for the child to eat. And that's where Mark's story ends. So the question is, what kind of story is it? If the little girl had actually died the way people who were there in the house believe she had, then it's the story of a miracle as dazzling as the raising of Lazarus. And it testifies to the power of Jesus, the power that he had over even the last and darkest powers of all. And if she was only sleeping, as Jesus said, in a coma or whatever he may have meant, then it's a story about healing, about the power of Jesus' touch to make the blind see and the deaf hear and the lame walk, even if it's a story about a miracle, but about a miracle that doesn't end with an exclamation point the way you'd expect, but with a question mark, or at most a little row of dots that means unresolved, to be continued, to figure out somehow for ourselves. Who can say for sure exactly what it is that Jesus did in that house where Jairus lived, or how far down into the darkness he had to go to do it? But in a way, who cares any more than her mother and her father could have cared? They had their child back. She was alive again. She was well again. And that was all that mattered. I picture her as looking at like one of those photographs of Anne Frank, a wry little Jewish girl with a face full of irony and wit and a kind of bright-eyed exhilaration. I picture how it would have been to have the child that Anne Frank was back again somehow, the way she was before the gates of the concentration camp closed behind her. I picture how one way or another, if such a thing were to happen, we would all of us fall down on our knees. The whole world would fall down on its knees. Who knows what kind of story Mark is telling? But the enormously moving part of it, I think, is the part where Jesus takes the little girl's hand and says, "Talitha, come." Little girl, get up. And suddenly we ourselves are the little girl. Little girl, old girl. Old boy. Old boys and girls with high blood pressure and arthritis, and young boys and girls with tattoos and body piercings. You who believe and you who sometimes believe and sometimes don't believe much of anything. And you who would give almost anything to believe, if only you could. You happy ones and you who can barely remember what it's like to have once been happy. You who know where you're going and how to get there. And you who much of the time aren't sure you're getting anywhere. Get up, he says, all of you. All of us. And the power that's in him is the power to give life. Not just for the life or for the dead like the child, but to those who are only partly alive. Which is to say, people like you and me, who much of the time live our lives with closed to the wild beauty and miracle of things. The everyday things that we live and yes, even of ourselves. It's that life-giving power that's at the center of this shadowy story about Jairus and the daughter he loved, and to the lady in the crowd, that I believe is at the heart of all our stories. The power of new life, new hope, new being, that whether we know it or not, I think keeps us coming to places like this year after year in search of it. It's the power to get up, even when getting up isn't all that easy for us anymore. And to keep getting up and going on and on toward whatever it is, whoever he is, that all our lives long reaches out to take us by the hand. Let us pray. O Lord, you are indeed the healer of all our ills. We bring to you, Lord, our bodies, our minds and spirits, hurting and broken by the violence, ills, trauma and cares of a world separated from you. Come to us now with your healing powers. We ask that you heal us. Give us the strength, health, wisdom, and knowledge found only through you. Send your life-giving spirit so that we may live our lives with courage in the profound peace of your love. Amen.